Okay, so picture this. You're a law student, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed. You're finally in the courtroom ready for action, and all of a sudden, you're hit with this wave of scientific data expert opinions flying back and forth. It's like a whirlwind of jargon and complex concepts. How on earth are you supposed to make sense of it all? And as a future legal eagle, how do you navigate this tricky terrain of scientific evidence?
Ah, that's the million-dollar question, isn't it? And it's a challenge that lawyers and judges have been grappling with for decades. Now, today we're going to take a deep dive into a landmark case that completely revolutionized how we think about scientific evidence in court.
We're talking about Daubert v. Merrill Dow Pharmaceuticals, Inc., a Supreme Court decision that set a new standard for admitting scientific evidence in federal courts.
Exactly. And for all you aspiring lawyers out there tuning in, trust us when we say that Daubert is not just some dusty old case you have to memorize for an exam. It's a living, breathing framework that will influence how you approach pretty much every case that involves expert testimony.
So understanding Daubert deeply will give you a real leg up when it comes to building your arguments, cross-examining witnesses, and really understanding the reasoning behind a judge's decisions.
We've got a treasure trove of resources lined up for this deep dive, case briefs, expert opinions, even a perplexity analysis, all focused on dissecting Daubert from every angle.
And we're not just going to regurgitate the facts.
Yeah.
We want to equip you with a practical grasp of the legal issues, the Supreme Court's thought process, and the lasting impact that Daubert has had on the legal profession. Because let's face it, this decision is still shaping the admissibility of expert evidence even today.
Couldn't have said it better myself. So, to kick things off, let's set the stage. Before Daubert reared its head, what was the go-to standard for admitting scientific evidence in court?
Right. We often hear about something called the Frye standard. What's the deal with that?
Okay, so the Frye standard has its roots in a 1923 case, Frye v. United States. It was a pretty straightforward idea for scientific evidence to be admissible. The methodology or the principle behind it had to be generally accepted within the relevant scientific community.
So kind of like a scientific popularity contest, right?
In a way, yes. It had to have the scientific community's stamp of approval. Now, how did this Frye standard play out in the Daubert case itself? Well, the case revolved around claims that the drug Bendectin manufactured by Merrill Dow Pharmaceuticals was causing birth defects.
So a pretty high-stakes situation right off the bat.
Absolutely. The plaintiffs in this case brought in a team of experts to testify about the alleged link between Bendectin and birth defects. But here's the twist. Merrill Dow countered with a mountain of published, peer-reviewed epidemiological studies that found no statistically significant connection.
Ah, so right from the get-go, we've got a clash of scientific titans. It sounds like the methods used by the plaintiffs' experts were a bit outside the mainstream at the time.
You hit the nail on the head. Their evidence relied on alternative methodologies, like in vitro studies, which are basically test tube experiments, and in vivo studies, which involve animal testing. They also brought in chemical structure analyses of Bendectin and even reanalyzed existing epidemiological data. Now, while these approaches can definitely be valuable in scientific research, they hadn't exactly gained widespread acceptance in the fields studying birth defects and drug effects.
So they were pushing the boundaries a bit with these newer approaches.
That's a great way to put it. And because of this, the district court decided to exclude the plaintiff's expert testimony based on the Frye standard's requirement of general acceptance.
So that really highlights the central dilemma here, doesn't it? We've got these potentially groundbreaking but not universally embraced scientific methods going head to head with the weight of established peer-reviewed research that the defense is putting forward.
Exactly. And this is where the legal plot thickens. By the time the Daubert case made its way up to the Supreme Court, the federal rules of evidence, particularly Rule 702, which deals specifically with expert testimony, had already been established. Now, here's the catch. Rule 702 didn't explicitly mention the general acceptance standard.
So now we've got a real legal showdown brewing.
Right. It's a battle of the standards. The Supreme Court had to grapple with a fundamental question. Should the admissibility of this new wave of scientific evidence be determined by the trusty old Frye standard, or by the seemingly more flexible framework of the federal rules of evidence? What should be the ultimate gatekeeper?
And in a landmark decision, the Supreme Court unanimously sided with the federal rules of evidence. They effectively dethroned the long-reigning Frye standard.
A truly pivotal moment, Justice Blackmun, in writing the majority opinion, was crystal clear that the Frye standard had been superseded by the federal rules of evidence. The court emphasized that Rule 702 places a premium on scientific validity, in other words, reliability, as well as its relevance to the specific facts of the case.
So it's not just about whether the scientific community at large has given its blessing. It's also about whether the evidence is grounded in solid scientific principles and whether it actually speaks to the issues at hand.
Precisely. And this is where the idea of the trial judge as a gatekeeper really takes center stage. The Supreme Court made it clear that Rule 702 implicitly assigns a vital responsibility to the judge.
So the judge isn't just a passive observer anymore. They're an active guardian of the scientific integrity of the evidence being presented.
Right on the money. The judge has to ensure that any scientific testimony allowed into court is not only relevant to the case, but also rests on a solid scientific foundation. They have to prevent what we often call junk science from polluting the well of evidence.
Now, this brings up a really practical question. How are judges who are legal experts, not necessarily scientists, supposed to determine what's scientifically sound? Seems like a pretty tall order.
It is a weighty responsibility, and the court recognized that to give judges some guidance, they laid out what have become known as the five Doebert factors.
Yes, the famous Doebert factors. These are like a judge's toolkit for assessing the reliability of scientific evidence, right?
Exactly. They're not a rigid checklist, though, but rather a flexible framework to help judges evaluate the trustworthiness of the science being presented.
Okay, so let's break down these five factors one by one. What's the first thing a judge should consider?
The first Doebert factor is testability. Can the scientific theory or technique in question be tested or disproven using the scientific method?
So can we actually put it to the test through experiments or observations?
Exactly. The court reasoned that real scientific knowledge is usually built on testable hypotheses. If you can't potentially prove something wrong, it's hard to consider it truly scientific.
Makes sense. What about the second Doebert factor?
The second factor is peer review and publication. Has the methodology or the findings been scrutinized by other scientists in the field through peer review? And has the work been published in reputable peer-reviewed journals?
So it's like a quality control check by the scientific community itself.
Precisely. And the third Doebert factor gets into the nitty-gritty of reliability. We're talking about the known or potential error rate of the scientific technique.
So essentially, how often does this technique or method produce inaccurate results?
You got it. Understanding the margin of error is crucial for a judge to weigh the evidence's probative value. If a method is prone to a high error rate, it's going to raise some serious red flags.
That seems pretty fundamental to determining whether the evidence is trustworthy. What's the fourth factor all about?
Factor number four focuses on the existence and maintenance of standards and controls. Are there established professional standards or guidelines that govern how this scientific technique is applied?
So we're talking about things like standardized lab procedures or set protocols in engineering or other technical fields.
Exactly. These standards help ensure consistency and minimize the potential for bias or human error. Think of it like a recipe for good science.
So it's about bringing a level of uniformity and accountability to how the science is conducted. All right, we've covered four factors. What's the fifth and final one?
Now, this one might sound a little familiar. The fifth Doebert factor is general acceptance. Remember the Fry standard we talked about? Well, the Supreme Court didn't completely throw general acceptance out the window. It still has a role to play, just not as the sole deciding factor.
So if a scientific method is widely accepted within a reputable scientific community, it's still a point in its favor, but it's not the end-all be-all anymore.
You got it. And here's a crucial point. The court made it clear that these five factors aren't a rigid checklist. They're meant to be flexible guidelines, and a judge has to consider the totality of the circumstances when assessing reliability.
So it's not just about checking boxes. It's about taking a holistic view of the evidence and the science behind it.
That's the essence of Doebert. Now, I remember reading that Chief Justice Rehnquist, while he agreed with tossing out Fry, had some reservations about the Doebert standard itself. What were his concerns?
Yeah. Chief Justice Rehnquist raised some interesting points in his concurring and dissenting opinion. He was worried about the practical side of things. Could judges who often don't have extensive scientific backgrounds really handle this new gatekeeping role effectively? He questioned whether they were equipped to wade into the complexities of scientific methodology and make sound judgments about reliability.
He had a valid point. It's a big ask for judges to become instant experts in every scientific field imaginable. This tension between the need for solid scientific evidence and the practical limitations of the legal system is a key debate that continues to surround Doebert.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Now, after the Supreme Court laid down the law with this new Doebert standard, they sent the Doebert case itself back down to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals for another look. What happened on remand? How did the Ninth Circuit apply this new framework to the evidence about Bendectin?
Well, even with the more flexible Doebert standard in place, the Ninth Circuit still ruled that the plaintiff's expert testimony was inadmissible.
You're kidding. Even with the bar seemingly lowered, What was their reasoning this time?
So the Ninth Circuit took a close look at the specific methods used by the plaintiff's experts, particularly in how they reanalyzed the epidemiological data and drew conclusions about causation. And they found that there was a significant lack of peer review specifically for these methods. They also noted that these methods weren't widely accepted within the scientific community that studies birth defects and drug effects.
So even though Daubert moved away from that strict general acceptance rule, it still demanded scientific rigor and a clear link between the methods used and the conclusions drawn.
Exactly. It wasn't enough to just present novel ideas. The burden of proof still rested on the plaintiffs to show that their evidence was grounded in solid scientific principles and methods. And in the Daubert case itself, the Ninth Circuit didn't find that their evidence met this threshold even under the new standard.
So Daubert had a direct impact on the Bendectin litigation, but what about its broader legacy? How did it reshape the landscape of expert testimony in the legal system going forward?
Daubert's impact has been massive and far-reaching. Initially, it was focused on scientific evidence, but the Supreme Court later expanded its reach in a case called Kumho Tyre v. Carmichael.
Ah, yes. Kumho Tyre, another landmark case.
Mm-hmm.
So what did Kumho Tyre add to the Daubert story?
Well, in Kumho Tyre, the court said that the principles of Daubert should apply to all kinds of expert testimony, not just scientific evidence. So it now covers experts from all sorts of fields, engineers, accountants, forensic specialists, psychologists, you name it.
Wow. So now judges are tasked with evaluating the reliability of all kinds of specialized knowledge, not just hard science. That's a huge expansion of their gatekeeping role.
You can say that again. And this broader application of Daubert has led to ongoing debates and discussions. One of the biggest concerns, and it echoes what Chief Justice Rehnquist was worried about, is whether judges are really equipped to assess the reliability of such a wide range of expertise.
Yeah, it's one thing to be a legal expert, but to also be a scientific or technical expert in every field that comes through the courtroom, that's a pretty tall order. It raises questions about whether judges are truly capable of making those nuanced judgments about reliability.
It's a valid point, and it's a discussion that's still ongoing in legal circles. Another area of debate is whether Daubert might inadvertently create an uneven playing field in the courtroom.
So how could Daubert potentially lead to an imbalance in the legal system?
Well, some argue that the strict requirements of Daubert, particularly the need for strong methodological support and top-notch expert qualifications, could give an advantage to parties with deeper pockets who can afford to hire those high-price experts and conduct more extensive research to meet the Daubert criteria.
So while Daubert aimed to elevate the quality of expert evidence, there are concerns that it might create barriers for those who don't have the resources to keep up.
Exactly. It raises questions about fairness and equal access to justice, which are core principles of our legal system. But despite these ongoing debates, there's no denying that Daubert fundamentally changed the game. It shifted the legal system away from that more hands-off approach to scientific evidence under Frye and towards a more proactive and discerning role for judges in evaluating the validity and reliability of expert testimony.
So like the court said, all right, judges, we're entrusting you with this crucial responsibility of making sure that the expert evidence presented is both relevant and trustworthy.
Precisely. It's a big responsibility, but it's also a testament to the importance of ensuring that our legal system is grounded in sound and reliable evidence.
Okay, so as we wrap up this deep dive into Daubert, what are the key takeaways that our listeners, especially our future legal eagles, should really remember?
First and foremost, the Supreme Court threw out the general acceptance test of Frye as the sole standard for admissibility. They ushered in the Daubert standard with its multi-factor approach focused on the reliability and relevance of expert testimony.
And they gave judges this crucial gatekeeping role to ensure the scientific soundness of the evidence.
You got it. And we can't forget the ripple effect of Daubert. It now extends to all kinds of expert testimony in federal courts, not just science.
So for all you law students out there listening, a deep understanding of Daubert is essential. You're going to encounter cases involving expert evidence, and Daubert will be your guide. It'll help you assess that evidence, prepare your cases, and understand the reasoning behind judicial decisions.
Absolutely. As you continue your legal journey, I encourage you to really think about the balancing act that Daubert tries to achieve. It wants to ensure that only sound and reliable expert evidence is admitted in court, while also acknowledging the challenges that judges face in acting as these scientific and technical gatekeepers.
It's a fascinating tension, and it's something that legal scholars and practitioners are still grappling with today.
Exactly. In our increasingly complex world where science and technology are constantly evolving, the question of how to strike that balance becomes even more crucial. Does Daubert get it right? Or are there tweaks and refinements that we need to consider?
It's a question that's worth pondering as you embark on your legal careers, because ultimately it's about ensuring both the integrity of the evidence presented in our courts and equal access to justice for all.
Couldn't have said it better myself.